the 30s, there are three teams that dominated the league: New York Giants, Green Bay Packers, and the Bears. And nobody could come close to us.
It's the WGN Radio Football Podcast.
Who knows, maybe we come out running like wing T or something.
Right on cue, Justin Fields to the end zone.
With your host,
the one and only
Kevin Powell.
We're rolling and it's go time.
Let's talk football.
All right, another packed podcast, episode 19 of the WGN Radio Football Podcast. Thanks for tuning in. I am Kevin Powell, and just as I finished up editing this podcast, it was all good to go, ready to send in to the producer, get posted. Major breaking Bears news. Khalil Mack done for the year with season-ending foot surgery. That injury had kept him out of the last two games heading into the bye. And obviously a major blow to this Bears defense, but it explains why the Bears went out and signed 34-year-old Bruce Irvin to add some depth. But, man, that's rough for the Bears, who have a matchup with the Ravens and Lamar Jackson coming on Sunday. Do talk more about the Bears-Ravens matchup with Matt Verderam from FanSided. I also talk with Michael O'Brien from the Chicago Sun-Times, previewing the semifinals of the IHSA State Football Playoffs. And I figured with Thanksgiving around the corner, people are tailgating this time of year, I talk with Dr. Barbecue, Ray Lampe. He's a big Bears fan. He's from Chicago. And if you're into barbecue and whole cooking world and all that, you probably recognize that name. But I figured I'd mix it up a little bit. Talk some turkey, talk some tailgating, talk some football with Ray Lampe. But let's start with my conversation with Matt Verderam from FanSided. All right, the Bears' upcoming opponent, the Baltimore Ravens, are coming off a loss to Miami. The Dolphins' defense did a really good job slowing down Lamar Jackson, an MVP candidate. Did you watch the entire game, Matt? What can you tell us about this Ravens team?
Yeah, unfortunately, I watched the whole game. I had no choice for my employment. But you know what? It was a game where Miami basically said, we're going to bring six or seven guys on every down. Certainly every passing down, and you're going to have to go ahead and beat us. Now, Miami has some really good corners. They've got Howard, Byron Jones. They can do that more than some other teams can, and they can play cover zero and not worry about getting beat over the top. My bigger intriguing point out of that was it kept Jackson from being able to run, because they really, if you watch them, they didn't overload blitz. They didn't force him to one side. They just kind of evenly blitzed the line and tried to close in from the corners, and they're really successful at it. And so I'm curious to see this week, you know, do the Bears believe enough in their corners to do it? You know, Jalen Johnson's been really, really good this year. Do they believe in the other guys enough to say, you know what, we can play that same way. We're gonna get up on the line, and we're going to show an all-out blitz. We're not going to let Jackson out of the pocket. You know, it's dangerous because it's the kind of defense where you can get some huge plays out of it. You can also miss a tackle and give up a 75-yard touchdown. I mean, that's the risk you run. So, you know, certainly Baltimore, I'm sure, went to school for the last 10 days on how to beat that type of defense. But I think if you're the Bears, you make them prove that they can beat it.
Yeah. Now, Jackson had missed two practices this week with a non-COVID-related illness, but he was back working out Friday, so expect him to be playing Sunday. Jackson was held to 9 carries, just 39 yards, 26-43, 238 yards, touchdown, interception. He was sacked 4 times in that game as well. Not easy to sack Lamar Jackson.
No. And again, I think a big part of that was the way they blitzed. He really had no escape route. You know, if he had to hold the ball at all, it was over. And this is a weird year at Baltimore. I think when you think about the Ravens, the last couple of years, you think about this team that they're an amazing running team. They don't really throw the ball. They're this really good defense. They bring a ton of pressure. They blitz more than anybody. I mean, those things have been true of the Lamar Jackson era. They're not really true this year. I mean, they still do run the ball, but they're not nearly as effective as they've been in the past. Now, Jackson's going to rush for over 1,000 yards again, unless you get hurt. He's having another, you know, year where his legs are easily their biggest weapon. But they've thrown the ball more this season. I mean, you know, Marquise Brown is over 700 yards receiving. Mark Andrews is about 650. Now, they have nobody else who has 300. So it's those two guys. Rashad Bateman has played and played pretty well here, coming off injury. He's only played 4 games this year, but he's on about a 1,000-yard pace. So they've thrown the ball a lot more and better, although in recent weeks that's slowed. You know, Jackson in the last 4 weeks has only had 6 touchdowns to 5 picks. He struggled. He's averaging about 200 yards a game. It's not been prolific as it was earlier in the year when he really was on quite a clip. So I think Chicago, you know, this is a game where offensively, I think the Bears actually are going to have success in this game. They should. Baltimore is one of the worst three or four defenses in football. But can they stop Jackson? That's always the question when you face Baltimore in that offense.
For Bears fans, is they've been, I don't know if I want to say giddy, but they are on a four-game losing streak. But I don't know if a fan base has ever felt better after a four-game losing streak, and that's because of Justin Fields. We talked about Fields last time you were on. His past two games have been, you've seen development, right? And that's what you want to see in a rookie quarterback is him getting better. In the past two games, the clear, you know, weakest link on this offense was the passing game. They were dead last in just about every passing category. And the past 2 weeks, you've seen clear development from Justin Fields in the offense. So that has led to fans being like, okay, they've lost four straight, but Justin Fields is starting to look like the guy that we've needed here in Chicago forever. What do you make of Fields? Are we hyping it a little bit too much from the national perspective? What did you see in Fields in that Steelers game? He had some crazy impressive throws against Pittsburgh. They did end up losing, but he put him in a position to win that game. Your thoughts on Fields and where the Bears' offense has been over their past couple games?
Yeah, I think you said it right, Kevin. I mean, early in the year, my God, they couldn't throw the ball for 200 yards in a game. I mean, it felt impossible. And let's be real about it. Fields struggled. You know, there were a lot more picks than touchdowns. You watch the game. Not all about his fault. You know, some of that was the offensive line. Some of that was the line of weaponry. Some of that coaching. But he really did struggle. Against Pittsburgh, easily to me, his best game of the year. Easily. He looked like a top 10 level quarterback. You know, making throws on the run, making throws in a tight window, getting the ball down the field. And that's, for me, in today's NFL, I don't care what your completion percentage is. I care that it's above, you know, 60. But it, you know, people go so crazy over, well, Mac Jones is completing 70% of his passes. Well, he better be. Every throw he makes is 6 yards down the field. Right. I mean, who cares? I don't care. You know, to me, I'm far more impressed by a guy who completes 65% of his passes, but he's throwing the ball down the field. They're getting chunk plays. You know, there's a lot of nuance and context that goes into that stuff that you just don't see in a box score. Now, I thought Fields against Pittsburgh, listen, they got robbed in that game. They should have won that game. Mm-hmm. And that was a performance that if he plays like that, the Steelers are not a very good team offensively. They're a very good defensive team. And he was very impressive. If he plays like that against Baltimore, they're going to have a very good shot to win the game. Baltimore, other than the Jets, is the worst defense in the league yards per play against. They are dead last in passing yards allowed per game. That is a bad defense. It's a defense that gives up a lot of big plays. It's a defense that does not get many stops. You know, they consistently get beat. The question in this game for me is, A, Allen Robinson is going to play. You have Darnell Mooney, who I think is primed for a big game. Cole Kmet, what does he do? You know, they're going to need to air the ball out a little bit in this one. And after watching the way Fields played against Pittsburgh, I think it's possible.
Yeah, and that's one of the reasons, too, I think fans are giddy about Justin Fields. He's fearless. He loves to throw the ball down the field. He makes throws down the field. You're talking about those chunk plays. He had them in Pittsburgh. He had a lot of them. And more. He had more in that Pittsburgh game, it feels like, we had seen in Chicago over the past 3-4 years. And I'm not kidding. That's how bad it's been. Where he is fearless. He is willing to air out the ball. And I think that's I'm actually picking the Bears to win. I think it'll be close. But if they can, to your point, don't get crushed by Lamar Jackson. And this defense has been prone, the Bears defense, to allowing big chunk plays. We saw it on that last drive for the Steelers. Let's just have some fun with this. It's still an extremely small sample size. We're only about halfway through, well, a little more than halfway through the regular season now. But you cover the NFL, the draft, all of that. If you were to redraft the quarterbacks in the first round of this year, how do you think it would have played out?
Well, I still am of the belief, if I had the first pick, it's hard to say. It's when you throw more picks and touchdowns. I would take Trevor Lawrence first still. And he's not been good this year. He's not been good. But that team is a disaster. Mm-hmm. Like, so much of quarterback play goes into your situation. Like, if Mac Jones was in Jacksonville, I can't express what a disaster that would be. But he's not in Jacksonville. He's got Bill Belichick. So, you know, and that's part of the deal. That's the way it works. I still think Trevor Lawrence is going to have a really great career. I just think he's got to get the heck away from Urban Meyer. After that, I think I would take Jones. I've got to be fair. I mean, he's played very well. Then I would go with Fields. Then I would go with Lance. And then I'd go with Wilson. I do not think Zach Wilson's good. I didn't think Zach Wilson was good coming out of college. I know I talked to scouts around the league who, listen, certainly had nice things to say, but there's a very big sentiment around the NFL of he had one good year at BYU. He had really good players all around him, including a great offensive line, a really good running game. Like, how's this thing going to play out if he goes to a team that's not good? And, of course, the Jets obviously are the epitome of not being good. So, yeah, I think, look, Fields might move up, though. Like, if Fields, to me, what if they got a really, really good offensive mind in Chicago and they gave him another weapon or two? Like, I could see Fields being the best guy out of this class in 3 years. But right now, I still think Lawrence, the talent's so obvious. I just worry that Jacksonville's going to break that kid before he has a chance to figure it out.
It is interesting, and I think it's because he's in Jacksonville and he's not in Chicago, or, you know, he's with the Jets or the Giants or something. Like,
right.
Kind of feels like that storyline has fallen under the radar a little bit, again, because it's Jacksonville, and I know there was some Urban Meyer drama. But, man, if Trevor Lawrence was in a different market, I think he's taking a beating from a fan base, and I don't know exactly what it's like with the Jaguars fans right now, but... Yeah, I'm interested to see how that plays out. I hope they don't break him. I think he's got all the talent, as you said, and a legit player as well. Best team in the NFL right now, who you got?
God, got a dartboard?
That's what makes it fun, right?
It really, I agree with you, Kevin. It is. It's, to me, you know, I've covered the NFL now on a national, you know, full-time level for 6 years, seven? Yeah, 6 years. And this is, of all those years, this is the most wide open I can ever remember it being. You know, normally you get to this point and you go, okay, you know, it's two teams, three teams, they're the best. Or maybe you even have a year where you go, that team is the team. You know, New England, some of those years, you go, okay, they're the best team in football. You could make a real case right now for at least 10 teams winning the Super Bowl. Like, maybe as you get toward the back end of that 10, maybe it's a little bit more of a stretch, but I think you have to pick one of these teams in the NFC because the AFC is such a disaster. I know this is enemy territory. I'd probably say the Packers only because defensively they've been lights out over the last month. They've been really, really good. And they don't even have Jair Alexander, they don't have Za'Darius Smith. And the offense, you know, with Rodgers and Adams and Jones, they're going to be fine. That offense is always going to move the ball. I just think it's going to come down this year more than ever. And this always is a huge factor, but who's healthy and who's hot? Like that, it's just, you know, especially in the AFC, where you look at it and just go, all right, you got Tennessee, but does anyone really believe? Like, right now, Tennessee and Arizona have the two most impressive resumes in the NFL. I don't know of one person that covers the league that thinks that's going to be the Super Bowl.
Right.
Like, I don't know anybody. I don't know one person that says, yeah, I think Ryan Tannehill is going to the Super Bowl. I don't think anyone believes that. You know, I think, you know, if Kansas City, who I cover closely and what, you know, for fan side, I think if they play the way they played on Sunday night, I don't know that anybody's beating them in the AFC. Like, but they've been so inconsistent, it's hard to say. I think Buffalo is overall the most talented team, but they've had some mind-blowing losses. So I like the Packers by a smidge, but you could ask me on Monday, I'd give you a totally different answer.
Well, I think, you know, the Cowboys-Chiefs matchup Sunday at 3:25, I can't wait to see that one. I think that one will be, I don't know if telling's, I think we'll learn a lot in that game.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, it's going to be a game where, you know, I was just actually going over some stats, kind of getting ready for that game, because I do the Arrowhead Attic podcast for us as well as the Chiefs, which I came up covering. And I think, you know, early in the year, they were historically bad on defense. And that's not hyperbole. I mean, they were, like, in four different categories at one point. They were the worst in NFL history, like four games of the year. Their last three games, their defense is giving up 21.2% on third down. They've been terrific in the red zone over the last five games, 50%, which put them like seventh. And they're facing a Dallas team that obviously is loaded. I mean, between all the receivers they have, the two backs, Dalton Schultz, a tight end, is underrated, he's a really good player. And, of course, Dak. That's going to be a great game. Like, if Dallas wins that game, I think any doubt about Dallas is completely erased. And if Kansas City wins that game, they're then 7-4, and you start looking at their schedule. They go to a bye next week. They come out of that bye, they play nobody. I mean, the only games that you'd say are even remotely difficult, they're at Cincinnati, and they're at the Chargers on a Thursday night. They got, you know, Denver twice, the Raiders at home, the Steelers at home. You're still looking at the Chiefs and going, they might go on quite a run. So, huge game, really interesting, maybe a Super Bowl preview.
And you mentioned the Bears-Steelers game and how and I've already covered this on the podcast, but I'd love to get your thoughts on it. I mean, that was really, really, really bad officiating. This taunting rule is driving everybody insane. They have their reasons, fine. I think what's frustrating to everybody is that it's not being called fairly, where there are certain instances where he certainly could have thrown a flag that was similar to what Cassius Marsh did. There doesn't seem to be a clear definition of what exactly the rule is or how it'll be enforced. Your thoughts on the taunting rule, and it doesn't seem like they're backing away from this at all, but it's driving everybody nuts, and I really do not want it to play a major role in the playoffs. That would be disastrous.
It would be. I couldn't agree more. And look, you know what? I'm never one to bring up officiating as a reason for a team wins or loses a game. I mean, unless it's just so unbelievably blatant, like the St. Rams in the AFC title game a few years ago. The Bears got robbed. I mean, the Bears, forget even the taunting penalty. What about the penalty that took away a touchdown?
Mm-hmm.
Where it called for a 15-yard penalty for a low block. You didn't even touch him. I mean, that's a horrible call. And up to the point, gambling's been legalized now almost all over the country, certainly in most areas. And the NFL has gotten in bed with it. The NFL, I mean, hell, the Saints, are, you know, the name of the stadium is after Caesars. Okay, like, the NFL cannot pretend like they're not in love with gambling at this point. They clearly are. I mean, you watch an NFL game, how many times do you see a gambling commercial? So, I think the NFL's got to understand, we're taking in all this gambling money. Fine, they should. I don't blame them. But with that comes a responsibility of, all right, we need to be making sure that we're getting every call right as much as humanly possible. Because, look, I'm not saying there's any nefarious events in Pittsburgh, but we saw that in the NBA. I mean, we saw that happen. Like, to think that just can't happen in the NFL. And when you have these taunting penalties, they're huge penalties, 15 yards, a first down. You know, if there was ever an official who just decided, hey, look, I'd like to make some extra money on the side here, like, that's an easy way to do it. That's a real easy way to do it. Those are so subjective that you could easily throw a flag or two here or there. So I think the NFL should really go to a situation where they have a little bit of, you know, a sky judge, so to speak. You get to look at these real time. You don't even have to go over to the monitor. Just, hey, look, no, that's a bad call. We're getting rid of that. You have to have a little bit of a check and balance here. And I, you know, I get the people who say, well, replay, it already takes long enough. Let's be honest. If you're getting the call right and it takes an extra 2.5 minutes per game, who cares? I mean, you're sitting through 17 football games. Everybody sits down and watches the NFL from morning till night anyway. Like, if it's 2 extra minutes, I really think the NFL, for its own benefit, has to be very careful with this stuff, because now more than ever, the incentive is there for, hey, you know what? What's going on? You know, I could throw a flag. I could not. Or just, you've got millions of people around the country who are betting on your game.
Right. That's
You should be taking care of those people.
Well,
like, you can't.
Yeah.
You can't have games screwed over on stuff like that.
That's the angle I would go through. Like, yeah, sure, you could. You know, who knows? Maybe there will be some scandals someday when it comes to that. But like, now that more and more people are putting their money on the game, you can't have games coming down to these calls. You can't. You're just going to infuriate fan bases. I realize people are still going to be placing money on it. I don't think anybody's just going to be like, I'm done betting because of the taunting call. But still, like, if you are, as you put it, in bed with these sports books and the casinos and all of that, like, you can't have this poor of officiating, right? Like, this is people. We're talking money here. We know how people get when it comes to money, right? Like, you can't be messing around with horrible calls. And, I've gone on plenty of rants on this already, but, like, the fact that, and I've heard some coaches sort of, even Matt Nagy was kind of defending, Mike Tomlin defended it. You know, it's like, well, the kids are watching. I'm like, come on. You really think you're going to lose youth participation because of taunting in the NFL? Like, are you kidding me? And you're setting some sort of bad precedent of all the things that might be wrong with the NFL? That's what you're worried about, of all things, is a little bit of celebrating or a little bit of taunting? Like, come on. Like, I don't know why this was the direction they decided to go with, but I didn't think, Matt, that taunting was a major reason there's youth participation in football is down. I don't think anybody's, you know, little Timmy's not getting signed up for youth football because his mom doesn't like taunting in the NFL.
No. And, you know, look, I'm actually one of the rare people. I mean, I'm 33. Everybody in my generation seems to love it all. I don't care. Like, if you don't want to have taunting, fine. But, like, what Cassius Marsh did as an example, that's not taunting. He's 30 yards from the sideline. Like, if he had gone to the sideline, like, ripped his helmet off, started screaming at Mike Tomlin, fine, throw a flag on him. He was 30 yards to the sideline. Who cares? I mean, at some point, these are grown men playing an incredibly barbaric game. Some guy makes a great play and wants to get up and celebrate. Fine. And by the way, most people are cool with that. They want to see emotion. They want to see passion, all the rest of it. I don't understand why the NFL wants to take away. I've always leaned, I have no evidence of this, but I always think some of it is with sponsors. You know, if enough sponsors complain about something, and a lot of sponsors, let's face it, are run by people who are 80 years old in an office, and they're stodging, so, you know, all of a sudden the NFL goes, well, you know, geez, you know, I don't know, for an example, you know, Pepsi doesn't like the way these guys celebrate on the field. Maybe we should rein it in. I don't know what other reason there would be. I don't know why otherwise the NFL would care. I can't imagine that the players have any issue with it. I don't think, even though the coaches are saying the quote-unquote right thing, I don't think they really care either. But again, I go back to the gambling aspect of all this. Look, if you're going to take in all this money from these books and from these companies, then you need to do everything you can, A, to ensure the integrity of your own game. And again, to be clear, I don't think that game was, like, you know, fixed or anything, but you know, as a sports league, your integrity is everything. You have to make sure that you are doing everything you can to uphold your integrity. And for the billions of dollars that get bet on all of your games, you have to be doing everything you can to make sure you're getting the calls correct. If that takes an extra 3 minutes, so be it. I guarantee you, Johnny's not turning off the television because the game went to 3:05. But that's not going to happen. So I really do believe the NFL, they have all the technology and money in the world. You need to figure this stuff out. We should not be seeing games like that Bears-Steelers game. That should never happen in the NFL.
Yeah. I know this has been tossed around, and there was that the NFL officiating strike, or there was a labor dispute. I don't know what that was, 4 or 5 years ago, and we saw how big of a mess. And I remember talk of making them full-time employees, and I still don't think they are, but I know that's been tossed around again. But you know, it's the officiating is, and I will say this too about the taunting. You mentioned like 15-yard first down. Like, why is it such a severe penalty? Like, why can't they have? And I think this even for some other rules too, like a 15-10-5 mark. Like, how egregious was the penalty, whatever it may be? And I know it's tough because there's a million different scenarios that could play out. But like, you know, it could be, hey, it's just a 5-yard penalty and the Steelers still have to punt because of the Cassius Marsh, rather than, like, I don't know, a player throwing a football at another player's face. That maybe is a 15-yarder. I think you could have, like, levels of taunting penalty. You know, maybe that's something they could also consider. I don't know. It just seems insane to me that it's like a 15-yarder automatic first.
Yeah, well, it actually, when you think about it, like, I never really looked at it in that light, but it's a good point because if you think, okay, what's worse, like Cassius Marsh being happy about a sack or somebody like taking off? Like, remember the Mason Rudolph, Miles Garrett melee?
Right.
That turned into a full-on brawl, and guys got 15-yard penalty. Now, of course, a couple guys got thrown out of the game. But there were probably, 10 guys, 15 guys involved in that fight? Most of those guys got 15-yard penalties. Mm. Like, I mean, at some point, look, I understand the NFL. They have a product that they want to sell. They probably feel like the more taunting there is, the harder it is to sell. This is a joke, by the way. They could sell that league no matter how much taunting there is in it. But I understand that point of view. My problem with it is it's so ridiculously enforced. And by the way, again, I am never somebody I don't believe in talking about officials, blaming officials. I think a lot of time that's a loser's ballot. But I also think, we saw a game last weekend, Tennessee-New Orleans. I don't know if you happened to see that roughing the passer call on Tannehill. That's one of the worst calls I've ever seen. I mean, Tannehill was like barely touched 15 yards. I mean, it took away a Saints interception. That completely changed the game. If the Saints missed the playoffs by a game, that call cost them the playoffs. And fans don't think about a lot of times, you know what that means to some of these guys? How they have bonuses tied in. Hey, if you make the playoffs, you get an extra $500,000 this year. What it means for coaches. I mean, that is the difference between keeping your job and getting fired. The NFL cannot miss these calls, and I get wanting to protect the quarterback, because if you watch a game with backup quarterbacks, you understand how bad it is. But you cannot go so far overboard the other direction where some guy gets like a fingertip on the side of the helmet, 15 yards. It's an automatic first down. Everything that happened got erased. You can't. You just cannot go that route. We've got to figure out a better way to officiate these games, because quite honestly, it's the worst I can remember the officiating being in a long time.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons, too, is because of, like, the overthinking of all of it and just not using common sense. They try to put rules in place to, you know, limit egregious penalty. I just think they've overcomplicated the officiating system, if you will, where it just, a lot of times to me, it can just simply come down to common sense. By the way, there was one where Ben Roethlisberger basically just got hip-checked and kind of bumped in that game, Bears-Steelers, and he got a flag for that too. And I will say, this is my last little rant here I'll go on to you, Matt. Like, the idea that a veteran quarterback, and you can apply this to, like, basketball, right? Like, Michael Jordan used to get calls that other guys don't. That's stupid to me. That doesn't make sense. Just call it what it is. There's no reason Ben Roethlisberger should get more flags than Justin Fields, because Roethlisberger's banged up and he's an older quarterback, and the guy's got ice packs all over his body. How does that make any sense, where a guy like Roethlisberger, and Fields said this, he's like, yeah, that's the common thought. You know, he's like, typically the veteran guys get more calls. That doesn't make sense. It makes no sense to me. It doesn't matter what the sport is, whether it's a pitcher who gets a call on the corner compared to none of that makes any sense to me, why you would give favoritism to a veteran guy, call the penalty how it's supposed to be called.
Yeah. No, two quick points on that. First of all, I completely agree. And, you know, by the way, in that game, Roethlisberger, that one ball that he tried to throw down the field and went like 40 yards and the receiver had to come back, that was the most unimpressive 40-yard throw in the history of the NFL. That looked like he threw a medicine ball. It's time for him to retire.
Yeah.
But, you know, I started watching football in the 90s as a kid, and maybe, you know, part of that was being a kid and you don't quite have the recollection correct. I don't know. But the one thing that does amaze me, when I was a kid, there wasn't all this, like, okay, on the castle, for example, there wasn't this, like, he's got to take three steps, accept the ball into his heart, and then he's got, like, it was just, did he catch it?
Right.
And you had enough common sense
to
just go, yeah, he caught it. Or no, you know, he didn't have possession of the ball. Like, and that was it. There wasn't this, like, nine-step process to figure out what a catch was and what it's not. I mean, and that speaks to your point. I agree. Like, it's gotten to the juncture where it's so over-officiated. They worry about every little thing. Look, anyone with eyes can figure out, okay, yep, he's got possession. He's got both feet on the ground. That's it. He caught it. Like, just use what you would use on a playground.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand how you watch a game and some guy catches the ball, turns, takes a step in three quarters, gets rocked, fumbles the ball. That's incomplete. No, it's not. He caught it and turned upfield. He fumbled it. It drives me. It drives me insane.
It does. Well, we covered a lot there, Matt. I appreciate you jumping on. Can I get, before you go, a Bears-Ravens prediction? I'm predicting a Bears victory. Maybe I've got my Bears optimism goggles on, but I think Justin Fields, his progress over the past couple games, I got Bears 27, Ravens 24. But who you got in that matchup?
It's actually funny. It's exact. I have the same score, but just the other way. I think the Bears will cover. I think this is going to be a good game. My question in this game for Chicago, that I just don't know the answer to, and that's why I'm picking Baltimore, is can they do a good enough job hemming Lamar in and keeping him in the pocket? If they can do that, I actually think they will win the game. I agree. I think they'll win. But this is a game, you know, Baltimore, it's weird to say it because they're 6-3. They're kind of desperate. They're coming off a loss to Miami. And if you look at the Ravens' schedule the last seven games of the year, there's not a tougher schedule in football. The Bengals on the road, they already lost at home to. The Steelers twice, the Browns twice, the Rams and the Packers. Like, you better win this game if you're Baltimore. So I think it's really close. Can the Bears hem Lamar in? If they can, I think they win. If they can't, I think it's close, but I think the Ravens would find a way.
Yeah. Now, I will say this, too. The Bears under Matt, I've been referring to it as the Nagy way, which is the Bears shooting themselves in their own foot, which is constantly, like, dumb penalties and offsides, and they come out of a timeout last 2 weeks ago against Pittsburgh, and there's an illegal formation. There's been so much of that under Matt Nagy. So, you know, we'll see. But it's Justin Fields makes the Bears watchable. Imagine if they didn't have him. That would it would be a rough Bears watch. But, Matt, I've kept you for about 30 minutes here. A lot of great stuff we covered. I appreciate you jumping on the podcast.
Hey, no problem. Anytime.
All right, thank you to Matt for joining me. Now my conversation with Michael O'Brien from the Chicago Sun-Times. Michael, the season's flying by, at least for me. I know you're very busy covering football and now high school basketball, but here we are, down to the semifinals now.
Yeah, football always goes real quick. That's one thing. The basketball season is a long marathon, but yeah, football is really fast. And that's for the teams who are still playing. A lot of them were done weeks ago.
Right. So, well, we are down to just four teams remaining in each class. Let's start with 8A. And by the way, I think every single game this weekend is Saturday. I think there's one Friday night game in 4A. Correct me if I'm wrong, but I think just about every game is a Saturday afternoon or night game, right?
Yeah, everything's Saturday except tonight down in the Springfield area. It's Sacred Heart Griffin against Rochester, which is actually interesting because it's a father coaching against his son.
Is that right?
Yes. it's like a legendary Springfield Sacred Heart Griffin's coach, Ken Griffin. He's a legend. And his son coaches Rochester, and they meet up pretty regularly in the playoffs, and I guess they both hate it, but it keeps happening.
Well, as a storyline, that's all. Well, you look at both. I guess let's just start with this matchup then, since you brought it up. Rochester scored 48, 55, 57. Sacred Heart Griffin scored 49, 42, 55. I would bet the over in this one, Michael.
Yep, this family enjoys offense. Derek Leonard is the Rochester coach. We saw them actually. I've actually seen that team because they came up here and played Loyola, if you remember, in the a couple weeks ago. But anyway, I have no idea who's going to win this. It's like whoever's going to score the most. It's a family affair, and either one is going to be a huge underdog, most likely against Joliet Catholic in the state title game. But it should be a fun one.
Yeah, so Joliet Catholic, you're not sensing an upset in that one by Richmond. I mean, they're one of the best. Obviously, Joliet Catholic always one of the better teams in the state, but that's your pick there, obviously?
Yeah, I think Joliet Catholic could win 8A.
Wow, so, really?
Yeah, I mean, we saw them beat Brother Rice at Brother Rice this season. So, yeah, Joliet Catholic is really, really good. It's, you know, not to get too off topic, but I know somebody was talking on one of the Metamagic Tim's message board about it would be nice if we could arrange the football playoffs by, like, how good the teams were and not by enrollment, because it'd be pretty fascinating if we could have, you know, Joliet Catholic, Brother Rice, Maine South, and Loyola all playing for the same title instead of the way we have it. But anyway.
Yeah, and I always thought it would be cool. I know it's high school football, so you probably don't want to keep them going any longer, but I always thought it would have been, you know, cool, maybe through, I don't know, 5A through 8A to have, you know, the state champions of those classes play each other, and then maybe even the bottom four. I don't know. It's just something I've always thought about that could be cool and, you know, probably never going to happen, but something to think about. Who knows? Maybe they'll make changes down the road.
But who knows? Yeah.
Who knows? All right, let's go back to 8A. It is Loyola versus Lockport playing at Loyola Saturday at 1 o'clock. Who you like there, Michael?
Well, I'm going to do, you know, whenever Loyola shows a chink in the armor, I like to just kind of grab in and rip it open and hope that maybe they won't win every game. And they definitely showed a chink in the armor last week. I was pretty shocked they only beat Lincoln Way East 3-0. Obviously, Rob Zvonar and Lincoln Way East, you know, they know how to play defense. You know, they know how to coach defense, but they just don't have the athletes and the experience they usually do. So the fact that they were able to hold Loyola down to just 3 points has to be a warning sign for them. That was pretty interesting. Now, the question is, Lockport has a really good defense. They did give up 22 to Glenbart North last week. And they have a quarterback who hasn't thrown an interception all year. So you like to think maybe there's a chance there. I think Loyola is just better than Lockport, but I thought they were more than 3 points better than Lincoln Way East. So maybe it'll be closer. This one will be at Loyola. So, I mean, so is the Lincoln Way East game last week, so I don't know. It's hard to see Loyola losing, but there was cause for concern last week.
And then in the other 8A matchup, I think this could be a really good game, Michael, about between Marist and Maine South. They'll be playing that one at Marist 1 o'clock Saturday.
Yeah, this is the best game, I think, of the weekend. Marist, you know, they didn't look real good in the conference. They lost to everybody. Those are their three losses. Now, obviously, those are really good teams, not Carmel, Loyola, and Brother Rice. But they just, it wasn't that they lost. You know, I was at two of those games. It was that they just weren't in the game late. You know, it just, they didn't seem close to those other Catholic League Blue teams. Now, they've turned it around, and they've looked pretty good in the playoffs. They're scoring, you know, Dontrell Jackson Jr., they got a really talented quarterback going to Coastal Carolina. Meanwhile, Maine South has just kind of, they've had to come back in two or three consecutive games and just scraped out wins against teams. But they have been winning consistently all year. I mean, this is a toss-up, I think. I think Maine South might be the better team, but Marist is at home. They're on a roll. This one could go either way.
Yeah, I'm really excited to see how that one plays out. Maine South, by the way, won by 1 point over Neuqua Valley last week, and then they edged out Plainfield North a couple rounds ago, just 21-18. They rolled over New Tree in the first round, but yeah, to your point, they've played some nail-biters. We'll see how that one plays out. Over to 7A, it's Brother Ice against Wheaton North, Saturday at Wheaton North, 4 o'clock. What are you seeing there, Michael?
Saw Wheaton North again last week against Willowbrook in some horrific conditions on Friday night, which no high school football teams look good in weather like that. You know, you just can't, especially when Wheaton North throws the ball well. You know, they just weren't able to really do that, but they gutted out a win against a tough Willowbrook team. I just don't think they have the horses to hang with Brother Rice. I mean, maybe they can make it close, but I don't know. I think Brother Rice is a good 2-touchdown favorite in that one.
A Brother Rice St. Rita state championship matchup would be pretty great. But St. Rita meets Prospect. This one's at St. Rita Saturday night. Prospect, you know, you and I talked about the Mid-Suburban League. I'm always a little biased towards the MSL as a Hersey Husky. But, you know, they won pretty convincingly over Jacobs last week, 35-21. St. Rita has their stud. What's the situation with Caleb Brown? He's the Ohio State recruit you've been talking about through the playoffs, who's missed most of the year with an injury. Is he full go now? What can we expect there?
Full go, I don't know, but he played plenty in the last game, and he played a little bit in the game before, so he's going to be out there. This is looking like the preseason number one team I thought they were right now, St. Rita. Now they have Caleb Brown back. They've been playing very well. Prospect, man, give them a ton of credit. They're on like their third or fourth string quarterback. Somebody who hadn't played there all year, winning playoff games, that's amazing in a 7A level in high school football. So it's been a really impressive run for Prospect, but it's going to be really tough for them at St. Rita. I'll be at that one. I'm going to check it out. I'm going to hopefully get a look at Caleb Brown this time, which I've been looking forward to. And yeah, it looks pretty likely we're going to get that St. Rita Brother Rice title game in 7A, which would be pretty neat.
Yeah, as Mike Clark pointed out in his Sun-Times Game of the Week notes, Prospect's defense, 6 takeaways over the past couple of weeks. So we know how football goes. If you can create those takeaways, anybody can win. So we'll see about that one. But your Brother Rice, St. Rita seems like a likely matchup. Over to 6A, who you like? We got Cary Grove, who I know you're big on. They're taking on Lake Forest. And then it is East St. Louis. I know you're big on them as well. They're 10-2, but two of those losses were against national opponents, and then they're facing Crete Moni. What do you like in 6A, Michael?
Yeah, kind of like, you know, this 6A is pretty much gone like what everybody figured. Cary Grove is a heavy favorite at home against Lake Forest, although Lake Forest is, you know, I thought they were a threat heading into the playoffs. They were clearly playing well, but getting all the way to the semis, you know, tip your cap to them. That's a really nice season they've had. It just seems like it might be kind of a bridge too far, especially at Cary Grove. You know, that's on grass. They have, you know, a very interesting style with the triple option, and they're a tough out, Cary Grove, and they're very experienced at winning in the playoffs. East St. Louis at Crete Moni, oh boy, buckle up. That's going to be a very high-scoring affair. I mean, it should be interesting because Crete Moni has some athletes, you know, that can at least hang with East St. Louis, so that'll be interesting. They kind of like to play the same way. They're both wide open, so that's going to be interesting. But yeah, most people, I've not seen East St. Louis in person yet, but most people think they're the best team overall, and Crete Moni, you know, is a 6A team. You know, they've got kids playing both ways, and that's tough against a team with the size of East St. Louis.
All right, and then on to 5A. What do we need to know about these matchups?
I'm going to be at Sycamore-Fenwick, the 5A game. I've been dying to see Fenwick all year. Caden Cobb, he's a quarterback headed to Ball State. You know, he's right there, you know, maybe a notch right now under Jack Lausch for Player of the Year, but his numbers are incredible. Fenwick's got a bunch of other guys that are going to play college football. I'm excited to see them against Sycamore. They play out at Triton College. Fenwick is the favorite there. You know, they've been the favorite in 5A all along. It just seems weird to say that since they're not like these other teams, you know, that have won multiple state titles. They've never even played for one, but this could be the year. Everything seems on board for Fenwick. They're the big favorite in that game. And Kankakee's against Morton, Illinois, they're playing. It's Morton down by Peoria, not the one over in Berwyn. But Kankakee's the favorite in that one. Starting to look like maybe I underestimated them all year. I saw them last season, or, you know, in February, in that short season and a rainy Saturday, and they didn't look real great, but it looks like they have an awful lot of athletes that don't really excel in a rainy grass field that I saw, because they've really played well here in the playoffs, and they're the favorite in that one.
All right, we touched on 4A. Anything you want to add about the lower three classes, Michael? Anything you can...
3A, we've got IC Prep, you know, over in Elmhurst. They, I mean, they just, they're always here. You know, that program is so consistent. It's really well coached. They had a lot of high-level players the last few years. Kyle Franklin is a kid that, you know, if things had gone different, might have been a player of the year one of these last couple of years. He's gone now, but they've just kept winning. They're going to host Byron, so I'm guessing they're a favorite. I can't say I know a ton about Byron. And then it's worth pointing out in 2A, we do have a local team. Wilmington is hosting Tri-Valley in that one. So it'd be kind of fun if we could get a local representative in Class 2A into the state title game.
Hey, and by the way, how was that Brother Rice Mount Carmel atmosphere? We talked a lot about that on the last episode. Brother Rice obviously won by 41-28 in that matchup, but that was a very much hyped game. What was it like there?
Yeah, it was fun. You know, it was cold. So that's part of the problem. But, you know, a lot of assistant coaches on the field screaming about things. my big takeaway from that. I mean, it's got a little ridiculous at some point, you know, from both sides. But it's, you know, it's a little tough in a football game when it's, to me, the weather is so bad and the wind's blowing. You can't really hear a lot of people. You know, there were a lot of young kids all around kind of watching around the kind of ring around the stadium, not in the stands. So that helps add to the atmosphere. But the stands are so far away there that that's not super great for, like, it's not like at Mount Carmel, you know, where everybody's on top of you and there's a great atmosphere. At Brother Rice, it does feel like you're a little displaced from the crowd, except for the young kids. That was neat to see them all enjoying the game. That was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I saw some stuff you posted and some other stuff pop up on Twitter as well. Looked like a good atmosphere for the most part. But any other news or nuggets you want to add in or sprinkle in here as we got our second to last weekend of high school football, Michael? Anything I missed?
Nope, I think we're that about covers it. It should be, you know, these all should be pretty good games. You don't see many blowouts coming, so that's one of the benefits of not having any real big upsets. You know, sometimes upsets are fun, but then a couple weeks later, it's like, oh, these games are lame. Whereas that hasn't happened. All of the kind of favorites have gone through, so we should have a lot of good games the next 2 weeks.
Awesome. That's Michael O'Brien from the Chicago Sun-Times. Follow him on Twitter, Michael S. O'Brien, and we will talk to you next week as I'll probably talk to you before Thanksgiving as we get ready for the state championships in DeKalb this year. Friday and Saturday will be the state title games. And if you're into high school hoops as well, Michael does a great job covering that as well. I know it's a busy time of year for you, Michael, so I appreciate you making time for the podcast.
You know, it's a lot better than the alternative.
That's right.
We saw last year, so good. I'm okay with it.
That's good, right. Good to talk to you, Kevin. Good to be busy. Thanks, Michael.
Yeah, see ya.
Thank you to Michael once again. And if you're into food talk, tailgating, barbecue, all that good stuff, this segment's for you. Dr. Barbecue, Ray Lampe from Chicago, barbecue expert, join me. We just had some fun, talked some Thanksgiving, a little bit of tailgating, and then some Bears towards the end as well. Now joining me on the podcast, Dr. Barbecue himself, Ray Lampe. Appreciate you jumping on, Ray. I figured Thanksgiving around the corner, tailgating in full swing. You're a Bears fan. We'll get into that. But I really appreciate you jumping on the podcast, Ray.
All my favorite subjects, and it's always happy to talk to people in Chicago. So I'm in anytime.
All right. Well, you are from Chicago. We'll get into your Bears fandom in just a minute. But talk about, where did you grow up in Chicago, by the way?
Yeah, I was born in the city, and my parents, when I was four, moved to Berwyn. So I spent most of my life in Berwyn, and then I moved around out in that whole area. I lived in Oak Park and Lyons and migrated a little southwest, ended up in Willowbrook when I finally left about 20 years ago.
And how did you get into barbecue?
At the Mike Royko Rib Fest.
Is that right?
So this is legendary wow. For Chicago people. I was... I learned how to, in high school, I signed up, it was the early 70s, I signed up for a cooking class, just thinking it would be a fun goof-off class and we'd get to eat, and it was, but it was, you gotta remember, it was a different time. This class was to teach women how to cook for their families. It was, you know, it was a different kind of time. This was post-World War II, really. It wasn't like culinary education like now. But from day one, I enjoyed the cooking. I always cooked everything. I learned how to make blueberry muffins and a crab quiche and a couple different things that I cooked forever. And so then I was in my early 20s with, you know, living with a few of my friends. I was the only guy that ever knew how to cook, but I didn't know how to cook barbecue. And a friend of mine signed us up for the Mike Royko Rib Fest. It was a big deal. Mike made this big thing out of it in his column every day. And, you know, and so we signed up, and I was the only one who knew how to cook, but I really didn't know how to cook barbecue. So I literally borrowed a Weber kettle and learned how to make some ribs and a sauce, and I went out there and did it. And we didn't win anything, but I had found my people because I was a young guy. I was a 25-year-old guy that liked to cook, but now I was cooking out in the park with a bunch of other people with big grills and fire and big boxes of meat and a cooler of beer, and literally changed my life. Like I said, I had found my people, and we're coming up on, it was just about 39 years in September since that happened, and it's just been my life's obsession and my life's work at some point. So here's some trivia for you, though. The other guy that started his barbecue career that day is, well, the brothers, Dave and Larry Raymond, who created Sweet Baby Ray's barbecue sauce based on a top five finish in that contest. Wow. And ran, you know, Sweet Baby Ray's. We all know what that is now. So he's a friend of mine, Dave, the one brother, and we always talk about that. That's the day we both started our barbecue careers.
That's incredible. I did not know that at all. What a career it's been for you. Yeah, it's amazing what the barbecue community is. I know, you know, I have friends who they buy a kettle smoker and they get really into it. Like, it's the whole barbecue world. It's like, what do you think it is? I mean, other than obviously eating delicious food, there's something about barbecue. I don't know if it's, you know, the camaraderie, people standing around a grill watching meat smoke and having a couple beers, but it does seem like, you know, when people get into barbecue, they're all in on it.
Yeah, it's absolutely all of those things. You know, you got, so let's just think about barbecue in general, though. So what I just told you, the story about Sweet Baby Ray's, that's barbecue sauce. That's great, but that's not the same as cooking a piece of meat. It's not the same as owning or building grills. It's not the same as going around tourist barbecue. They go around to these 100-year-old restaurants around the country, and I do it all the time. It's this culture. It's just, there's so much more to it than just the actual. And then there is, of course, the food on the plate that we all enjoy, but it's just every one of it, every angle of it has these different stories. I tell people, so you walk in a restaurant, you see the chef, you're like, okay, cool, that guy's the chef. He's, you know, he knows how to cook really good, and he's the guy. You walk in a barbecue restaurant, you're like, oh, that dude's got some magical skills. He's like a wizard. We don't even know what that guy knows. You know, it's just so different than any other culinary thing. And the other thing that we, you know, this has been such a big part of my life, that we talk about, that it's the only true American cuisine. Everything else that we eat spins off from somewhere else in the world except barbecue.
All right, let's get into the Thanksgiving cooking here. The turkey. Everybody wants to know how everybody's technique is to cook the turkey. When Dr. Barbecue is cooking up Thanksgiving turkey, what's your technique there, Ray?
I'll give it to you. So what I do is, and this is because of my grandma. Now, I am a spokesman for the National Turkey Federation, but we like all turkey developers. But my grandma always bought a butterball. That was what she bought. There was no messing around. That's what we're getting. So to this day, I still do. And butterball and a lot of the big brand turkeys, they're essentially brined already. They enhance them with a solution that keeps them from drying out. So you don't really have to brine it. So defrost it for about 4 days, 5 days, if you got a giant one, in the refrigerator. You got to do that right. And then when you get it ready to go that day, what I do is get it all ready, get it on the counter, and I put a big bag of ice cubes, a Ziploc bag, like a gallon Zip bag, on top of the breast and walk away from it for an hour. And that way the breast meat will get really cold, and the thigh meat and the legs and all that, where you have a hard time getting it done, will all warm up a little bit. And it's amazing how much that helps. So that's 1 hour. And just put some seasoning on it, put an onion in it, maybe some herbs. And how do we cook it now? So we talked about the Weber kettle, great choice for cooking a turkey. But you put the coals all the way on the sides. Now, a lot of guys have got pellet cookers now, and I was a big Green Egg guy for years. There's a lot of different ways, but we want to cook indirect, no matter what your setup is. but not real low. You know, we talk about smoking. To me, smoking is something we do at 200, 225 degrees. That doesn't work that well for turkeys. For one, they get too smoky, but also the meat will get a little bit mushy. So if you cook them hotter, just like you would in the oven, I'll run my grill at 325, just like I would in the oven, indirect, and should take 2-3 hours. You know, use a thermometer. That's the way to get a turkey to not be dried out is don't overcook it. Get your thermometer. It should be 165 all over the place. And that's the basic rules. And you know, it's Thanksgiving. There's no reason to be messing around with something different. You want to talk about cooking one in March, call me and we'll talk about different ways to cook them. But Thanksgiving, heck, we're cooking it just like Grandma did.
And what's the side dish Ray Lampe's typically cooking up?
Well, I'm going to go for it. I made these really good, well, this is leftovers, but I made it really good. You take the leftover stuffing and turkey, make it into a ball, and wrap it in bacon. Ooh. And cook it till the bacon all renders off. That's pretty good. But at the house, we're going to have some grilled green beans. Put them in a pan and grill them up. But we're going to have typical mashed potatoes and stuffing and carrots. I like to cook my carrots in root beer.
Ooh.
You just get them on the stove and brown them a little bit and add a little bit of root beer to them. It's just a fun flavor, but in general, it's all pretty traditional. I don't get too far from center on Thanksgiving.
I hate to put you on the spot here, but and maybe you can name a couple. I know you're down in Florida now, but do you have a barbecue spot you love in Chicago or a couple that you like to go to or some that we should check out?
Yeah, for sure, yeah. Smoke, S-M-O-Q-U-E. If you haven't been there, go see Barry. It's been there for a while. Barry was like one of the new generation of barbecue guys in Chicago, and he's still doing a great job. They're over on like Irving and Pulaski near Irving. The other one I like is Green Street Smoked Meats down kind of off of Randolph Street. There was actually on Green Street. And those guys are, it's a cool place if you've never been there. It's a big warehouse. And we actually, when we were getting ready to open my restaurant, we went to a lot of places, and Green Street had the smoker we wanted. And they have it right smack in the middle of the restaurant. It's a big, giant thing from Texas. And we were so impressed by that that's exactly what we did. We bought one just like it, and we have it right in the middle of our restaurant. That's a great place. And then, you know, don't ever not go to Lem's out on the south side. Lem's is the old school OG Chicago rib tip joint, and man, it just doesn't get any better. So there's more, but I could live with those three.
I'm so happy you mentioned Green Street Smoked Meat. That's my go-to spot, Ray, so I feel like you kind of confirm that my barbecue taste is legit, because that's my number one spot. It's a very cool atmosphere.
Yeah.
At Green Street Smoked Meats as well.
It really is, but with that smoker they have too, you can't really do it any other way than authentic with that thing. It's a legit big time. They could cook 1,000 pounds of meat. Go, go there just to look at the smoker. And if they got it right out in the middle of the restaurant, they'll talk to you about it while they're cooking on it and stuff. But that thing runs on only wood. It doesn't have any gas assist, so if you don't put logs in it, it won't run. And the way it does it is it doesn't oversmoke the food. There's a lot of draft, a lot of air moving around. It's pretty hard to screw up if you've got that smoker. And now you've got to cook it to the right degree of doneness, but those guys have got, you know, it's like magic when you have that thing. And I think I never had that conversation with them. I've talked to them a lot over the years, but I would suspect they feel the same way about it. So you start out with a big, expensive piece of equipment, and it helps you. It's your friend. But then you got to care about it, too. You know, those guys are on that line there in the corner, and they care. They're happy to talk to you about it. They're proud of what they're doing. Yeah, that's a legit place.
All right. We'll get into Bears in just a sec, but you got any tailgating tips? Like, we're kind of in full swing tailgating mode here with football season rolling on, but do you have a couple go-tos that you like to cook up on game day?
Yeah, you know, when I tailgated at Soldier Field for like 20 years, pretty much all of Walter's career and a little bit before and after, we were out there and tailgating at Soldier Field, and of course in the run-up to the Super Bowl, which was epic. But my favorite thing to do was always ribs, because ribs, as a barbecue guy, are just something people care so much about. So what I would do is, I generally don't cook baby back ribs, but I did for tailgating because it just works a little better. And I would cook them ahead of time and cook them pretty much done. and cool them, and then cut them into like two or three bone pieces, and then put some sauce on them. And I would even do it in like a cardboard box with layers of aluminum foil in between and have it cool down. But then in the morning, I would just take it out to the game and fire up the grill. And all I had to do was basically warm these pieces up on the grill, and they were ready to go. And then I could throw the cardboard box away, and it was good. So I think, the main goal is take it serious. If you agreed to cook the dinner for all your friends for this tailgate party, don't be messing around. Don't show up hungover and just burn some bratwurst. Do something special. And for me, ribs was always the go-to and still is.
I love it. Imagine going to a Ray Lampe tailgate party. That would be something special. I would pay to go to that, Ray.
One time they were working on the parking lot or something at Soldier Field. I mean, this is probably in the middle of the 80s, and I was a young guy learning how to cook, and I was practicing making homemade sausage. So I made this sausage, I brought it to the game and cooked it, and we ate it, and I had put so much fresh garlic in the sausage, it was just brutal. And we knew all the people sitting around us, we were burping up this garlic sausage the whole game. Our friends in front of us are like, what did you guys eat? So they're not always that good, but it's always an adventure.
It's always fun, too. All right, let's talk Bears. Are you as hyped about Justin Fields as the rest of us? Because I'm all in on QB1 right now. What do you think so far?
Well, you're a young man, Kevin. As an old boomer Bear fan, I'm still suspicious. Mm-hmm. I've had this promise made to me many times in my life. Bobby Douglas was going to be the next guy, and so was Cade McNown and Rex Grossman and Jay Cutler. And, you know, so I'm just a little suspicious. But, boy, he sure looks good. So I'm feeling pretty positive about it. And it looks like modern football that I've never seen as a Bears fan, you know, and that's the kind of quarterback you need these days. So I'm trying to be optimistic. I've just been burned too many times before.
Yeah, no, I hear you. I mean, I've been cautiously optimistic, and I feel like Mitch Trubisky took a lot of – you had to talk yourself into that one, right? Like Mitch needs some time.
He's so bad I forgot to even name him.
Right. You know, and now I don't know, some of the throws Fields has made and some of the runs he's pulled off. I feel really good about Justin Fields. What are your thoughts on Bears Ravens for Sunday and the rest of the season? We're about the halfway point, but are you optimistic they could finish on a high note this season?
Well, I'm trying to be, and you know, the one thing I do like is the offensive line is coming together, and they've actually held up pretty good, all things considered. And of course, Fields and Mooney and Allen Robinson. I mean, you know, there's a lot of good pieces there. Cole Kmet coming to life. So, you know, we could actually have an offense, which is unusual because, I talked about the Walter Payton days. Even then, let's be honest, we didn't have much of an offense. We always relied on our defense. So, yeah, I am a little bit optimistic. You know, unfortunately, they got themselves in such a hole, it's going to be tough. But heck yes, I will be down here watching the game, I promise.
Ray Lampe's favorite Bear of all time. Who is it?
Oh gosh, it's hard to not say Walter Payton, but I don't know. I might go Butkus.
Yeah, I love it. I still watch highlights of Dick Butkus. It's awesome.
So he was talk about a badass man. He was the man.
Yeah, I know. Well before my time, but my dad always loved him, so I'll go back and watch some Dick Butkus YouTube highlights and stuff. It's a wild, wild football player. All right, that's Ray Lampe, Dr. Barbecue. Follow him on Twitter at Dr. Barbecue, drbarbecue.com as well. I appreciate you jumping on, Ray. Thank you very much.
Lots of fun, Kevin. Anytime, man. Thanks, Chuck, for calling.
And that's episode 19 of the WGN Radio Football Podcast. Thank you to Matt Verderam. Thank you to Michael O'Brien. Thank you to Dr. Barbecue, Ray Lampe. And thank you to Ernie Skett and Brian Altimer for their help producing the podcast, episode 19 in the books. Thank you for listening. Be looking out for a post-game pod a Sunday afternoon. Hopefully it's a Bears victory over the Ravens. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.